Life. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agner. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. Whether you are driving across the country or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be traveling with us. Tonight we have a slightly incredible program for you today. We have the Shadow Senator, Michael D. Brown, coming on the program tonight at 5:30 Pacific Time. Today there were 7 sunspot clusters on the sun with a massive 1711. So far, everything is quiet, even though there are 7 massive sunspot clusters pointed right at us with massive 1711, many times larger than Earth. A weak solar wind stream is brushing against Earth's magnetic field this week. It's fairly mild, 343 kilometers per second. In response to the encounter, NOAA forecasters put the odds of a polar geomagnetic storm today at 30%. High-latitude sky watchers should be alert for auroras. Just in case you were wondering why everything was going right, or for that matter, terribly wrong, there's an alignment of planets today, but don't bother looking because the conjunction is happening in broad daylight. Us. Venus and Mars have converged only 1 degree apart in close proximity to the sun. Well, tonight we have an amazing opportunity for you Earth explorers around the world. You have the chance tonight to speak to a sitting senator of the United States of America. For the past 5 years, Michael D. Brown has been the United States Senator from the District of Columbia. First elected in 2006 with 84% of the vote. He has served with distinction, receiving an award in 2010 from a coalition of activist groups, including the ACLU, for his contribution to the statehood movement. Yeah, that's right. Even though Washington, D.C. has millions of people in it, its policies and environment affect us nationally, it still is not a state. Has a senator, but cannot vote. But that's why Barack Obama said he has always been a strong advocate for the rights of D.C. residents. During his first term, he created a nationwide nonprofit, Teach Democracy D.C., to help students and teachers across America learn about the struggle for statehood for the District of Columbia. He created an online petition signed by residents in more than 35 states. He lobbied on Capitol Hill to get support for H.R. 265, their current statehood bill. And next week, Senator Brown debuts his own radio platform right here on the greatest webcast network in the world, BBS Radio. And by the way, his time slot is immediately before X Squared Radio. In the meantime, for the next 25 minutes, we have some things in the news. You know, from time to time, we cover the amazing algorithm of economics. And from a mathematical point of view, it is quite complex and thus fascinating. You know, we have talked about putting some, if not most, of your liquid capital right now into gold and silver, because these are the two metals that actually don't change value. Oh, they change the numeric value with respect to the dollar, but that's because the dollar is changing value, not the metal. So Mark Faber, who authors the Gloom, Boom, and Doom letter, is usually pretty bearish on stocks and bullish on gold, and that's why I find this piece particularly interesting. I call it the Golden Grave. He says that gold doesn't seem like it can catch a bid. He says, despite the continued reverberations regarding the Cyprus bailout and its involvement of bank deposits, gold struggled to maintain the positive momentum created in the first 2 weeks of March and instead now looks very much likely to move lower toward $1,580 per ounce, wrote Deutsche Bank commodities and analyst. This would be Xiao Fu in a note this morning. So what does Faber have to say about it? Interestingly enough, his explanation, it says, when you print money, the money does not flow evenly into the economic system, and he's right about that. I mean, come on, when they print money, do they send you an envelope with some money? Here, put this into the system. Oh, you didn't get your envelope? Well, I didn't get one either. That's right. That was something else. It was from the IRS. But no, that wasn't printed money. Anyway, it stays essentially in the financial service industry and among people that have access to these funds, mostly well-to-do people. It does not go to the worker. It's just mentioned that it doesn't flow evenly into the system. Now, from time to time, it will lift the NASDAQ, like between 1997 and March 2000, and then it lifted home prices in the U.S. until 2007. Then it popped. Then it lifted the commodity prices in 2008 until July, when the global economy was already in recession. And more recently, it has lifted selected emerging economies, stock markets in like Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand, etc., up to four times from 2009 lows and now the U.S. Come on. Is anybody watching the U.S. Dow? My goodness. So we are creating bubbles and bubbles and bubbles. And this bubble will come to an end. My concern is that we are going to have a systemic crisis where it is going to be very difficult to hide. Even in gold, it will be difficult to hide. However, I got to say, gold has been left pretty much to float to its actual value relative to the dollar. The more dollars we have printed, the higher gold has gone. It got nearly $2,000 an ounce, right? And we thought it was going to $3,000. Well, I would venture to say gold will probably make its way down in the mid-1300s before it settles down and makes a slight reverse. And that is precisely why I think Mr. Faber's right, that printing this money is inflation. Absolutely. It's classic inflation. It is why the number of dollars in the system keeps going up and why the Dow and the NASDAQ have been so well supported by it. But it doesn't make its way down to the markets that actually use it. It doesn't make it into the loan market. Never makes it to the loan market. The banks do not have money to loan. And let me tell you, let me ask you, if you know any different, you can give me a call. Toll free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to me, 530-413-9537. And don't forget, our conference lines are open, so if you want to go out and listen on your cell phone, you can do that. It's 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000. You can put it in your contact list on your phone, and then ~769-608#. That's the passcode, 769-608#. That will get you into BBS Radio Channel 2 Live. Now, let me say that there is a caveat I want to throw in here for precious metals, because I haven't mentioned silver. The silver accident is on its way. Silver dipped to $27 an ounce. $27 an ounce. So the short traders, not to mention any names, JP Morgan Stanley, are happy that it has gone from $36, $37 an ounce down to $27 an ounce. It may dip again, maybe to $24. But about that point, what's going to happen is that the vault, the largest vault in the world held by J.P. Morgan Stanley, is going to be tapped. That is to say, the people that actually own the silver are going to call for their silver to come home. And when that happens, silver is going to go long. And I'm looking for between 140 and 180 an ounce. Now, that's the normal value of silver. Relative to gold, it should be 10 to 1. If you got $1,400 gold, you should have $140 silver. That's where it should be. It is not there. Now, if you hold on to liquid cash, like dollar bills, it isn't going to bode well for you, in my opinion, even if you have the cash in a box at your house, because the federal government is tapping into the value of that cash. So you may put $10,000 in that box today, and in a month, you're only going to have $9,000 in there. No, they're not going to actually come and get your money, but the $10,000 will only be worth $9,000. See, 10% of the value of the money will be gone. However, if you were to take the $10,000 today and buy $10,000 worth of silver bars, or say gold, silver eagles, which keep in mind, that's only 31.1 grams of silver. The rest is copper to make it tougher and more resilient. That same $10,000 would be worth something like $100,000, or very close to $100,000, maybe $90,000, because the value of the silver never changes. It's only the number of dollars relative to the silver that changes. So with that being said, what do you do? Where do you put your money? Some people have called me, what do you do with your 401k? And I have said and still say, I have done it myself and it worked out fine. Sell that 401k right now while the stock market is on its peak. Take the 10% hit. Pay off all your debts, even your house if you can, unless you've got incredibly cheap money on that house. But if you have a lot of equity in your house, yours is going to be the first one they take when you can't make your payments. If you're buried in that house, if you're upside down in that house, then they're going to put you on the last list. That means that the 1.5 to 2 million homes that are sitting on the foreclosure bubble right now, and they're sitting there right now, we're going to get another wave of them as soon as the press will allow it. Yours is going to go behind those if you don't have any equity in your home. If you have equity in your home, trust me, the banks are going to take you first. So if you can, pay your house off. Get debt-free. It's a perfect time to do it. Once you're debt-free, the amount of money that it takes to support your household goes way down. You can keep your house, keep your car, keep everything you've got in your yard and in your garage, and you can live on a minimum wage because that's all disposable income now except for your taxes and insurance. So believe me, it really changes your stress level. But if you keep your 401k, you're liable to see that is going to be adjusted along with the adjustment of the Dow, which is most assuredly going to come. It has to. It has no choice. Europe, the euro, the whole European community is not savable. It's not savable in the current credit market. And there's something else. Bernie Becker writes this wonderful story a couple days ago. This is something that raised its head back in 2011, again in 2012, but then it was just rhetoric. Now, in President Obama's budget to be released next week, it will limit how much wealthy individuals, and you can just put all the italics and flowers and smiley faces around wealthy that you want, because we have no idea who those are. Even though the article says, like Mitt Romney, dun-dun-dun, the dark and terrible Mitt Romney. Anyway, they're going to limit how much you can keep in your IRA and other retirement accounts. I told you, Mary J. Miller, remember the interview where she said, and when asked, Are you going to come after the private retirement accounts of Americans? There's about $17 trillion that Americans have saved up themselves by doing without for 10, 20, even 30 years, building up their own retirement accounts. And although they have money in the bank, so to speak, so when they turn 65 or 68 or 69 or 70 and decide to retire, they can do so not just surviving, they can do it in style. They can take cruises every year. They can pay off their homes. They can pay for their own medical. They can pay their own way because they put their own money aside. Are you going to go after that money? And Ms. Miller said, absolutely not. I will do everything in my power to protect those. Translation, first on the agenda. The proposal would save around $9 billion over a decade, a senior administration official said. Trust me, that isn't even close. While also bringing more fairness to the tax code. Again, apply the special audio italics to the word fairness. So we have two words, wealthy, which I'm sure you are, and fairness, which I'm sure they are not. The senior administration official said that wealthy taxpayers can currently accumulate many millions of dollars in these accounts, substantially more than is needed to fund reasonable levels of retirement saving. Okay, that's a phrase that we're going to put italics on too. Reasonable levels of retirement savings. Oh, come on. You don't need that trip to Cancun each winter. No. You don't need to go to Sydney, Australia. You don't have to go to the Scandinavian cruise. That's not reasonable. We're talking about reasonable single-wide trailer levels of retirement savings. Under the plan, a taxpayer's tax-preferred retirement account, like an IRA, could not finance more than $205,000 per year of retirement, or right around $3 million this year. Well, I got news for you. If you live in Washington, D.C., and you and your wife have substantial medical bills, you have your little scooter for the mall, you have your house down in Florida that you travel to in the wintertime, you have your apartment inside the Beltway or your condo, $205,000 a year isn't going to get it. But again, that's not reasonable. Now we got to move you out into the burbs where you can live on less. We'll put you in a special home for people of your age bracket. And then you can get by on $205,000 a year. Romney, Obama's 2012 opponent, had an IRA several to many times that amount, leading to questions about how the former Massachusetts government was able to squirrel away so much money. He had about $100 million in his IRA. Now, this comes on the heels of a Cyprus bank heist masterminded by the IMF chief. Of course, some of the Russians' wealthiest depositors were alerted through inside channels and were allowed to withdraw their money before the bank was closed, as we announced the day before it happened. We also played an audio clip of that interview. So now we have the precedent. We have the international precedent. We also have private investors and investment firms and institutional investors that have been trying to move money from Europe into the United States to put into small businesses to get them going, to get people hired, to get some manufacturing going, to get some kind of commerce moving in the United States again. And now, for almost 9 months, that money has been held up. It can't move, even though it's their money. It's in their accounts. They want to wire it from banks in Europe to banks in the U.S. to get these businesses funded so people can go to work. We can start making some money. The market is there. But it's been held back by the IMF. 9 months. And that tension is growing. Those investors want to move their money. However, the IMF has to reevaluate that money. They have to reevaluate that money. You can't just move that money at face value. that would hurt the bank that you're going to withdraw your money from. They have to use that money to leverage, to make loans, you know, to be able to buy cash, to be able to trade currencies. The bank loses that ability to trade using your money. So we're going to have to discount that money if you're going to move it to the U.S. And guess what? Some of those investors have said, well, if it's going to cost us money to move our money, we're not moving it. And so guess what? The unemployment song keeps playing on. However, some of those companies have said there's so much money to be made in the United States because of the market, the value, and the need for those products. They're going to bite the bullet. They're going to pay the IMF fees, and they're going to move their money anyway. You watch. In spite of the administration, they're going to do it anyway. Now, I do have in 8 minutes Senator Michael D. Brown coming on the program. His works are many. He has been in the business of supporting and leading and being an activist in D.C. for a long, long time. About 25 years, almost 28 years, he's been a resident there. He created a nationwide nonprofit, Teach Democracy DC, to help students and teachers across America learn about the struggle of Washington, D.C., one of the most populous, one of the wealthiest per capita, and certainly one of the most influential on national policy of any state in our union. And yet, it isn't a state. It's a shadow state. It's a shadow state. His petitions have been signed by residents in more than 35 states. And right now his bill, he lobbied to help this bill to get support for H.R. 265, which is a House resolution to allow Washington, D.C. to become a state. So why all the blockage? Why is it not going through? Why is it not being debated? Well, that's what we're going to find out in 7 minutes. I think it's going to be interesting to see why one of the most influential, wealthiest, progressive, successful states in the entire union is not even considered a state, is not even allowed to vote on those budgets that have been so crippling to our country. In a recent article, this is a global warming update, I just find it so interesting. The rhetoric is, of course, what you have to filter through. But the science is so incredible. You know, a few months ago, a group of students in Oslo produced a brilliant spoof video that lampooned the charity pop song genre. It shows a group of young Africans coming together to raise money for those of us freezing in the north. A lot of people aren't aware of what's going on there right now, says the African equivalent of Bob Geldof. People don't ignore starving people. So why should we ignore cold people? I mean, frostbite kills too. The aim was to send up the patronizing, cliched way in which the West views Africa. Norway can afford to make the joke because there, people don't tend to die of the cold. In Britain, they do because they're not prepared for it. It's supposed to be a moderate zone. But each year, an official estimate is made of the excess winter mortality. That's an excess winter mortality number. That's the number of people that die of cold-related illnesses. And last winter was relatively mild, and still 24,000 people perished because of the cold. The indications are that this winter, which has dragged on and on so long with such brutality, will claim over 30,000 lives, making it one of the biggest killers in the country. And still, no one seems upset. Now, they're not trying to get you to buy Britain jumpers and jackets and, you know, parkas. Somewhere between the release of the 1984 Band-Aid single and Al Gore's 2006 documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, political attention shifted away from such problems. The idea of people, especially old people and very young people, dying in their homes from conditions with which we are all familiar now seems relatively boring. The reaction to the 2003 heat wave, quote unquote, was extraordinary. It was blamed for 2,000 deaths. How about that? That's when Britain was really cooking, about 115 degrees in London. You'll remember. Everybody got upset. But 30,000 people die because of the cold and no one pays any attention. So, just to let you know, climate change is upon us. We are seeing much more brutally bitter cold winters than before. And I would venture to say the summers have become just as brutally hot on the other extreme. In a related article, this is slowly beginning to dawn on Ed Davey, the Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change. He has tried to point the finger at energy companies. That's where all the money is. That's where all the tax revenue could be. But his own department let the truth slip out in the small print of a report released on Wednesday of this week. The average annual fuel bill is expected to have risen by £76 by 2020, it says. But take out Davy's hidden taxes, carbon price floor, emissions trading scheme, etc., and we'd be paying an average of £123 less. So it isn't the heat bill that's made the bill go up. It's the tax bill that's made the bill go up. His department has been trying to make homes cheaper to heat, and in a saner world, would be his only remit to secure not the greenest energy, but the most affordable energy. Let's see here. All right, we have about 1.5 minutes. Let's go ahead and preempt that. Let's go ahead and bring Senator Michael Brown, Michael D. Brown, on the program. His bio one more time. He's affectionately called the Shadow Senator. He is a sitting senator. He created a nationwide nonprofit, Teach Democracy DC, to help students and teachers across America learn about our struggle for statehood for Washington, D.C., one of the most influential and certainly, I think, the wealthiest per capita of any state in the union. He created an online petition that was signed not just by residents of D.C., but residents of 35 other states supporting Washington, D.C. to be a full-fledged, recognized, voting state in the Senate. Wouldn't it be cool to have 102 senators? Be a little harder to have a tie then, wouldn't it? Welcome to the program, Senator. How are you?
I'm fine, Dr. Agnew. Thanks for having me. And I think, yeah, it'd be really cool to have 102 senators. And don't forget, we always have the vice president to break ties. He's the president pro temp of the Senate. So in case of a tie, he can always come in and break a tie.
Yeah, but in the past, it's always been 50-50 means 50-50. Now 50-50 is 51-51.
We'll just have to get – people just have to get used to it. 51-51. I like the ring.
Well, there are other sort of shadow states as well. We have Puerto Rico. We have these are states that get some benefits. They certainly have representatives in the Republic. And I guess that's a subject of great discussion tonight. So
we discuss it all the time. And the one thing that sets us apart is there's two things that set us apart. First of all, we've been part of America since America began. That's number one. And number two, we're the only one of those other territories that pays federal income tax. We're also the only territory, I guess there's three things, we're the only territory who doesn't have discretion or doesn't have power to run its own local affairs. All the other territories run their own local affairs.
Well, isn't that taxation without representation?
It is taxation without representation. That's exactly what our license plates say, and it's exactly the principle on which this country was founded, that you can't do that.
That's one of the main grievances that started the Declaration of Independence in the first place.
Absolutely.
And we have kind of a similar situation today, the other 50 states, and that is, we have departments, agencies, administrations, and bureaus that write hundreds of regulations that have the force of law each month, taxes and fees and all kinds of enforcement actions, but we don't have any representation in that government either.
Well, you know, that's what they say, right, that the devil is in the details. And you're right that even though you may have input into the way the law is created, the way the law is implemented is really up to bureaucrats. It's not up to the politicians for the most part. So, yeah, there is some truth to that.
The thing that always amazes me when you read the rules or you read the section or the part, like part 49 or whatever you're reading, is it will have that phrase in there, according to the secretary. And that kind of leaves it open for the secretary of energy, defense, you know, health and human services, et cetera, to make those interpretations as to what that law actually means with respect to regulatory action.
Well, you know, politicians always want to leave a lot of gray area. They always, you know, they always want to have wiggle room. They always want to be able to move things with inside the line. So very often legislation is vague, but it's purposefully vague just so that they can adjust it. Sometimes that's a good thing, but sometimes it's not a good thing.
Well, that's true. I'm just talking about the function of it. You know, you got Washington, D.C., which has to pay the ferryman but doesn't get to ride the ferry. And then you have the other 50 states with thousands and thousands of businesses that are affected by those regulations but have no input as to how those regulations are actually interpreted. So if there's any wiggling going on, it's small business out there on the end of the hook.
Very often, yeah. And that's why we all need to be involved. And, you know, I'm about to start a talk show next week. I hope you'll be on sometime. And that's really the idea behind it. It's called Shadow Politics. And the idea of it is to talk to people across America, because we can't seem to get a dialogue going in Washington, D.C., and find out what people really want, because they are, I think, left out of the process a lot. And even when they have input, I think that people feel that they're left out. So we want to engage people, and we want to bring them into the process. Democracy is not for sissies. It's for people that want to be engaged. It's not the easiest form of government. It's just the best form of government.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, republics require, you know, dirt on the knees and mud under the fingernails. It's not a spectator sport. It's not like a monarchy where you just, you know, long live the queen, and then whatever,
right,
you know, live on their magnanimity, shall we say. That doesn't often happen in politics.
Well, that's why Jefferson, you know, one of the first things he did was found the University of Virginia, and because he believed that an educated populace was essential to the survival of democracy, just for that reason, because you had to be engaged.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, we have a great public school system, but recently I read that 70% of high school seniors graduating from New York high schools were functionally illiterate.
It's absolutely terrible, and this is a problem that we face in Washington every day. The statistic in Washington is that in Washington, D.C., we are the most educated jurisdiction in America, in the sense that we have more residents with graduate degrees than any other city in America. And on the other hand, we have a 40% functional illiteracy rate. So that means 40% of our citizens in the most educated jurisdiction in America can't read the local newspaper. We have 51% of kids in some of our high schools in the District of Columbia dropping out of high school, which is just atrocious to think that in the nation's capital, the citadel of democracy, it's more likely that you will not finish high school in some high schools than that you will. So it's a real problem, and it's a problem for us. I know it's a problem for New York as well.
Well, I mean, that's the indicator, but what is the key product characteristic here? What's the KPI? What's the indicator that someone is not going to graduate high school? Do we discover this in the fourth grade when you kind of separate the readers from the non-readers in the fourth grade? Is it a lack of resources? Is it a breakdown in the American family home where they don't motivate a kid to do his homework and pay attention to school and get good grades? What is the control over that? Because we don't just...
I think you hit on several of the things that are certainly part of the problem. There is a different attitude towards education, I believe, than there used to be. Certainly in my family, it was considered to be the most important thing a person could do was to get a good education. I come from an immigrant family, and so that's certainly one problem. Another problem, a big problem, is poverty. It's, we see a direct link in the District of Columbia, for example, to poor kids' performance as opposed to wealthy kids' performance. And this is not necessarily a lack of resources, since we put more money into our school system than any school system in our region. And Montgomery County, Maryland schools, and Fairfax County, Virginia schools, which are our neighboring school districts, are among the best in the country. And Washington, D.C. schools are at the bottom of the list of states. So it's not just a matter of resources, but we need to redistribute the way we put resources. We need to give them to the schools that need them most. And there's a breakdown, I think, in the way we look at education. I think those are all factors.
Well, this let's go back to Jefferson. He said that the greatest key to freedom for any nation is to leave the control of the school systems on the local level. Keep the federal hands out of it, even for that matter, state hands out of it. And although there have been many attempts to federalize at least testing levels, there have been some federal attempts to standardize curricula, which is marching down the wrong path, according to Jefferson, and me as well. But that being said, each community has concerned parents that support the local school board. You have school board members, you have a superintendent, and the majority of most county budgets are spent in the school system. So where do we go wrong as a system with these kids? Because we don't discover this 2 months before they're about to graduate high school. We know this for a long time in their school career. When do we apply those resources to save those kids, teach them how to read, inspire them to learn how to learn? At what grade level do we get the best indicator something's not right?
Well, not being an expert on education, I don't know that I could answer that question, but I can tell you a few things from my perspective. One thing is, politically, we talk the talk with children, but we don't walk the walk, and that's true in education, because they don't have a constituency. You know, politicians move on the basis of what their constituents want them to do. They move by pressure. Well, kids can't pressure them because kids don't vote. So kids are very often politically the first on the chopping block. That's one problem that we have politically. And then for us in Washington, all I can tell you is that poverty has a direct link to how well kids do in school. So, I think we need to see the whole picture with children. You know, it's like the first thing that we want to do is we want to get rid of athletic programs and art programs in school when budgets get tight, because we can't see the the totality of education, and we don't take a holistic approach to it. We see, you know, you talk about federal standards with test scores. That's what we see as being the end result, test scores. And I don't think that's right. I think that we need to address the whole student, and we need to see education as a lifelong process that starts in pre-K and deals with every aspect of the human condition, not just math or science or English. We have to take it in its totality, and I think that would improve the way we educate people. We also need to adjust to the changing times. You know, when I was a kid, 75% of all women were found in only five professions. One of those professions, and the largest profession, was teaching. So what we had was we had an oversupply of teachers, super qualified women that were teachers, who we don't have anymore because they can be doctors and lawyers and business consultants and all sorts of things in today's world. In fact, they're found in all 158 professions listed by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So, and we haven't kept up with that. We should pay teachers more. We should compensate them better. We should do what the free market is supposed to do, and that is pay on the basis of how important their, you know, a particular person's work is, pay on the basis of what it means to us as a society. And I don't think we do that. I think teachers are underpaid and overworked.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I have always been fascinated by teachers and teaching, and I've done what I could to support, you know, teachers in the classroom. I've also been a strong proponent for working professionals to volunteer in the classroom, to come in and teach about polymers or electricity or chemistry or, you know, ornithology, all kinds of working professionals that can come in and, you know, expose kids to the profession in a way that teachers never could do. When I was a kid, I grew up in Pasadena, so we were always exposed to stuff from JPL and NASA and Caltech, and that's why I became an engineer instead of a doctor. I come from a family of doctors, but I like building stuff and designing stuff, so I went into engineering, and it was largely because of all those co-ops that I got to do at JPL. It was just fascinating stuff. I was flying airplanes at 14 because I could. It was available.
Right.
It's, you know,
and we certainly have a lot of that in Washington, too, in the sense that, you know, my oldest daughter danced at the White House. She's a dancer. And there are a lot of opportunities here through the Smithsonian and other NASA and you know, Congress, and there are a lot of things in Washington, a lot of opportunities made available to young people. And you're right, those experiences really are what shape you. And you know, it is, again, it's the totality of the experience. I know that you're a very well-educated man, and I know that I'm not sure if you know who Dr. Langmuir is, but Dr. Langmuir was the guy that invented the tungsten filament that made the light bulb practical. Many, many scientists had tried to make Edison's invention practical, and they couldn't, and Langmuir came up with it, and he was the only one that was not an electrical engineer. And they asked him, in the end, how he did it, and he said he didn't understand enough about electrical engineering to know that what he was trying was impossible. So he tried it, and it worked. And, you know, I mean, I think there's a sense of that in everything. You never know where knowledge will lead you, and you never know in the end who it will be that will, you know, what discipline it will be that finds a cure for cancer, whether it's a chemist or a doctor or a, you know, we need to take an interdisciplinary approach and a holistic, I think, attitude towards education, rather than just looking at math scores or reading scores or, you know, and I think we're moving towards that, but we're moving at an iceberg pace.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. By the way, don't forget Earth Explorers, our phone lines are open. anywhere in North America, if you want to speak to Senator Brown, it's 888.
Yeah, and I would love to talk to people. You know, I have 35 years experience as what we call in the District of Columbia, what we would call a political hack. I've been the guy on the sidelines for a lot of people. I've helped a lot of people get elected before I ran for office myself. So I love to talk to people. I love to engage people. I think that politics is a very, very noble pursuit. I know that that's probably not, you know, it's probably not the consensus of opinion because a lot of people that are involved in it certainly seem at times not to be very noble. But there are a lot of noble people involved. I think it's a really great thing, and I think the more we engage the American people, the better off we are.
Well, I totally agree. We don't speak too much about politics on X Squared Radio, but we do talk about political science. We do talk about how does history, the past, meet the future, where we are now trying to make policy decisions that engage the taxpayer with their government and how the republic works, how a republic works, and why sometimes we feel so detached from it, what forces are at work here and there, and what they can do in their own communities to affect those forces. Our phone number is 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. If you are outside the country, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. Any kind of policy question, any kind of question about current politics, especially if you have an opinion on the statehood of Washington, D.C. We are very, very interested in hearing from you.
Well, and you know, Dr. Agnew, I think that the kind of thing that you're doing right now and that I'm attempting to do and that other people are doing on the Internet, I think that there's going to be a revolution with this technology because it does open the door for everybody to get involved. You know, if you want a TV show or you want a radio show or you want a bully pulpit from which to give your ideas and opinions, it takes a lot of work and a lot of money and a lot of help. But the Internet is limitless in its ability to engage people and to start what I believe it will be a worldwide dialogue. I think we've already seen it. We saw it in Tunisia with the Arab Spring, for example, how quickly things change there. And I think that this will revolutionize politics. And I think it already has, but I think it will continue. The Internet will continue to revolutionize politics, especially in a democracy where your opinion counts.
You're absolutely right. You know, broadcast radio is a micro-effective pulpit. You have the broadcast range of however much power your local antenna is putting out.
Right.
And, of course, syndication gets you further out there as more and more radio stations broadcast identical content simultaneously. Like, you know, any of the talk show hosts that are out there, if they're syndicated, they're on anywhere from 10 to 700 radio stations at the same time. But webcast radio is everywhere. And we're one of the pioneers here at BBS Radio Network and usually number one on this network. And we reach the world simultaneously. And then in an archive fashion, anyone can come back at their leisure, at their schedule, and plug in and listen to the 3 hours of X Squared Radio. Plus, because we're an archive-driven media, we don't have commercials.
Right. Well, and you know what? You're also changing the way people relate to media. For example, my kids watch movies on the Internet. They get their music from the Internet. They get their news from the Internet. Every day the Washington Post gets smaller and smaller. So it's an emerging technology that's growing quickly, which has been embraced by young people all over the world, and I think it connects us in a way that no other mass media has ever connected us.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's audio, and sometimes we have video at the same time. Now, you mentioned earlier in your discussion that you thought that music programs and sports programs would be the first to go when it came to budget cuts in the schools. And The only exception that I take with this is that Harvard did a study, and in their business success roster, these are the ones that come to Harvard, get a degree, and then go on to be successful in their relative genres. The most successful consistently are ones that participated in high school band programs.
Absolutely.
They said that there's something that happens with rehearsing music with others that hardwires the brain for success, for business, for systemic thinking. And I just thought that was fascinating. Now, my youngest son was in band for 4 years in high school and then 3 years in college. So he's, you know, got all the benefits of it, and I love the band program. I think that's the one thing that makes college football so much better than pro is the marching band.
But, well, there you go. Yeah. I used to not that I was ever a great musician, but I used to play in the pep band in high school, so I know all the college fight songs, because that's what we used to play. You know, we didn't have a fight song. My high school wasn't big enough to have a fight song of its own, so we played all the college fight songs, and I still love them. But yeah, that's absolutely that's the point. I think that, you know, it's crazy to get rid of things like music and art and sports, because it does teach all those lessons. You know, we hear on, and we've seen many, many studies done that show how important sports are to developing certain things like cooperation and leadership and an ability to work with other people. We can say the same thing about music and art. And it's funny to me that we cut those programs, because we see them as non-essential. But when we look back in history at cultures, we don't look at their politics or their economics or their social life as much as we look at their art and their history and their music. We, in fact, sometimes we interpret those other things by looking at their art and their music. So, you know, these are things that we certainly know the importance of, and we certainly relish when we look at societies and try to evaluate them. Yet we see them, when it comes down to dollars and cents, sometimes we see them as non-essential, and I just don't understand that.
Well, I have a lot of my listeners that write to me during the program. They don't want to come on the air because they're just nervous about their voice and everything, but they're all writing me now. I played drums. I played clarinet.
Yeah, I did too. I played drums, and I often say that the best day and the worst day of my mother's life were the same day. It was the day she found out that my brother sold his drum set, but then later found out that he sold it to me. So she had to put up with the racket with him in high school for 4 years, and then with me. But yeah, I got a lot out of being, and I'm still a big fan of pop music, even though I don't play. I'm still a big fan of music and the arts. I go to the theater a lot. I listen to music all the time, and I think it's important. And we, you know, in developing the whole person. And I think sometimes we don't look at that. We don't look at developing the whole person. And when you want to, I'm actually reading a book now about Thomas Jefferson, and you talk about the whole person, you know, that's who these guys were. They knew everything there was to know in their time. They knew music and art and literature and science, and, you know, they made sure they were well-rounded. And I think we've lost some of that, the Renaissance approach to education.
Yeah, we have lost it, and we get off in the weeds when it comes to education. And I'm not sure that we don't, at least in some school districts, we hamstring the teacher. We get them involved in so many programs, and they have restrictions as far as what they can do for discipline in the classroom, and keeping the 28 kids is a lot of kids in a classroom. I can't remember how many was in my classroom when I was a kid, but I certainly had large high school classes. But that's a lot of kids to keep their attention. And, you know, when we talk about schools being underfunded, it's certainly the lion's share of most counties' budgets. But when you're paying a teacher not enough to support a family, only enough to be a second income in the home, that's what you're going to get, I feel.
Right. I agree with you. And when you look at the opportunities that are available to people, you know, if you have a master's degree and you're teaching in a high school, trying to take care of 28 kids at a time in a class, and with all their social problems and other things, there's a lot of things you can do in the world with that degree, which pay a lot more and have a lot lower stress. I don't think, you know, nobody goes into teaching to make money. I mean, I think you do it because you love kids and you love learning and you love education. But we still have to be sensitive to, you know, paying a living wage to these people because they have lives of their own. They have kids they have to raise. They have children they have to put through college. Your son, I'm sure, is gone through college. I have a daughter in college. 1 year of her tuition is more than I paid for my bachelor's degree and master's degree combined, the entire program.
Exactly.
I pay more for 1 year of her education. So, you know, we have to be a little practical about it.
Well, when you
and
look at
it, we have to do other things to induce teachers to, you know.
Well, the other things besides salary, I'm sure of that. But you're right. There is a particular passion that goes with it, and there's great satisfaction in watching a student who comes into your classroom in September and who leaves your classroom in April knowing something. They have a skill and a knowledge that they didn't have when they arrived. Now, that being said, most K-12 programs have as many administrators not in the classroom as they have teachers.
I know. It's crazy.
It is.
And it's something we have in Washington. We have such an administratively heavy school system. We even had a woman who was considered a revolutionary educator, Michelle Rhee, who tried to reform the schools in the District of Columbia. And she got rid of non-performing teachers, but she didn't get rid of any of the now the administrative staff is even more top-heavy than it used to be. And,
right.
I think that's just crazy. In a business, I ran a business for 25 years, and you would never have that.
No, we have, when we set up a manufacturing plant, we look for 2.5% of the budget is what we call indirect administrative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we run a plant with 330 people in it, we'll be lucky to have 16 managers to take care of a 3-shift, 7-day operation. And that's
I have a brother, my only brother, is president of the top community college in America. And they have people lined up around the block to get in because they're all about teaching, they're all about change, they're all about plugging kids into the community. You know, they train kids to go right out and get jobs in the community, and people are very much responding to that. They're responding to that, and they're responding to the fact that you can do your first two years in a community college, and it's less expensive. So those two things combined, they can't keep up with enrollment at his community college, and a lot of it has to do that they're plugged in to jobs in the community and the colleges in Appalachia where they've lost a lot of jobs. So that's another thing. You know, the way we educate people is sometimes just out of touch with what's going on in the world.
Sure.
And we need to change that too.
Sure.
And you're right. The thing you said about earlier about bringing professionals into the classroom from the community, it really makes a difference. Not only because they give you hands-on experience that you can't get in a classroom, but also because they reflect the environment. You know, when I was educated at the University of Maryland, that's where I got my master's degree, and one of the nicest things about being educated at the University of Maryland is that it was in suburban Washington, D.C., and many of my professors actually worked in politics. I studied political science, public policy, and many of them worked for government agencies or worked for members of Congress, or they had a lot of practical experience, and we had a great, really vibrant department because of that.
I think it would be so fascinating to be in a D.C. school, because look at the policymakers, look at the agencies that you have at your disposal in that area, where people can come in and talk about how the State Department works or how the Department of Commerce works. You just have a tremendous, tremendous resource there in Washington, D.C. Senator, can you stay with us through the break? We'll take a quick 5-minute break, a breather. Excellent.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. We'll be right back after this break. Take a little breather, get some refreshment. We'll be right back in about 6 minutes. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming to you.
The truth, I didn't come to fool you.
Geek Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. My guest tonight is Senator Michael D. Brown, the shadow senator from Washington, D.C. You know, as we get started with this second hour, I want to remind you that our phone lines are open anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. If you are outside the country, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. Also, all of the rest of the country that's digging itself out of a long and snowy winter, spring is upon us, and that means we throw open the windows, air out the house, open up the garage, dig out the leftovers, and we sort of take on new life. We take on new business. We feel, I think, better this year than we did last year. There's a feel of more opportunity, more chances to get something going, get a job, start a business, expand your business, hire someone else. And we encourage that that optimism in the United States of America. That's what this nation is all about. It's also about representation. It's about being part of your government, participating in it, contributing to it, learning from it, and being mad at it sometimes, and even, you know, taking part in it. And part of the discussion we want to cover this hour is the statehood of Washington, D.C. It is per capita certainly one of the wealthiest, most well-educated, most effective on policy, and I would say influential in the world, of any community ever in the history of the world. And yet its senators, and tonight we have Senator Michael D. Brown on with us, are not allowed to vote. They're there in name only. They're kind of the shadow in the shadow. And I want to encourage discussion on that. Welcome back to the program, Senator.
Thanks so much, Dr. Agnew. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the thing that stands out about it for me, I think, is we're the only country in the world that does this. No other country in the world denies the people of their capital city the same rights as every other citizen. It's somewhat of an anachronism that's a holdover in American politics. Because when the founding fathers founded the country and decided on participatory government, they really weren't sure quite how that was going to work. So they weren't real great. If they had a shortcoming, it was on enfranchising citizens. They didn't enfranchise women. Women weren't allowed to vote. African Americans weren't allowed to vote. Native Americans weren't allowed to vote. And in fact, even men that didn't own property were not allowed to vote because they thought you didn't have a vested interest in the system if you didn't own property. We were an agrarian society at the time. So they also thought they needed to control Washington, D.C., and they took away the rights of the people of Washington, D.C., and now we've enfranchised women and African Americans and Native women, Native Americans and people under the age of 21 and people that don't own property. The people of the District of Columbia are kind of the last big group that we need to enfranchise.
Well, what does the ACLU say about this? They're there to protect the civil liberties of Americans, and although some in the nation might argue that residents of Washington, D.C. are not Americans, they are. So how are their rights lobbied for by the ACLU on your behalf?
Well, the ACLU supports us, and they're part of our coalition, and the local ACLU, not the national ACLU, but the local ACLU in Washington, has been a leader in this cause, along with the League of Women Voters and then NAACP and other groups that you would, you know, civil rights groups that you would expect to be involved in our struggle. They have been involved in our struggle, and they lobby for us vigorously, especially at the local level. And whereas it is a partisan problem, because the District of Columbia is so heavily Democratic, even the local Republican Party is very supportive of equal rights for the people of District of Columbia. And it's funny, one of the reasons I've decided to start this internet radio show is because 80% of the American people, when polled, agree that we should have the same rights as everybody else. But 79% of the same group think that we already do. Because it's kind of counterintuitive to think that the people of the nation's capital don't have the same rights that you do.
Well, I can understand the colonial concerns that with so much policy-making power, decision-making power, regulatory power inside of one piece of real estate, you wouldn't also want it to have a vote. You want it to be dispassionate, sort of detached from the process. But that isn't the case anymore. Now we are a much more metropolitan capital city. It is not
well,
so...
Well, and the truth of the matter is that in California, you have more federal workers than you do in Washington.
Sure, sure, exactly.
And in Virginia, you have more federal, you know, people that really can influence the policy. In Washington, D.C., we tend to work in politics and we tend to work in the public interest more than we tend to work for the federal government.
Right, and it can be argued that it's somewhat of a crucible in Washington, D.C., and somewhat isolated from the, quote, real world outside the Beltway. And I'm just using the Beltway as a symbol, not as actual line in the sand, because certainly people that live in Silver Springs or Baltimore also, you know, have that influence and work inside that community. But that's generally what I'm trying to say. Now, you raised something interesting. You said most of the community is Democrat. I don't personally, and we certainly don't on this program, talk about Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, Independents, whatever. We talk about the American ideal. We talk about the idea that is, in my viewpoint anyway, somewhat divine in the fact that you derive the power of the government from the will of the people. However, what we have seen probably in the last 50 years is an apathy of the people for their government, a distrust of the government by the people. And that's not healthy either. And I'm not really sure where we turned the corner. But at some point, everybody feels disenfranchised in the process of government. And how do we fix that?
I think there's some truth to that, yes. And you know, again, quoting my favorite guy, Thomas Jefferson, that's exactly right. He said that the legitimate power of government comes from the consent of the governed. And he also said that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all are created equal and that they're endowed by their creator. So, you know, in Washington, we take personal offense to this because we really don't see it as a right of Congress to give and take away our rights, even though that's what they do. We see these rights as divine, part of our humanity. So we feel especially disenfranchised here in Washington. But I understand that people don't think they have the power, and in reality they do have a lot of power. If you look at the presidential election, for example, between George Bush and Al Gore, a handful of votes made the difference. A handful of votes decided who the next president was going to be. So individuals do have a lot of power, but you're right. They feel disenfranchised. They get disassociated. We still haven't figured out how to engage young people. You know, young people don't vote very much. And in general, even in a city like Washington, D.C., where you have what we in political science call the attentive public, you know, people that are engaged, we're lucky if we get more than half the people out to vote. Half the people that are registered to vote. That doesn't even include the ones that aren't registered. So
less than half
the electorate votes in the District of Columbia, and it's a hard thing for me to understand as somebody that believes in the democratic process why people would not at least go out and cast a vote.
Well, there's a dielectric, as it were, between the people and the government, and it's generally this. Government officials, either those that are elected or those that serve as bureaucrats, believe that they are highly informed. They understand the impact That is to say, the effect of what their words are going to have or don't have on the community. And so they have a respect for that power. They have a recognition of that power. They also realize, as Benjamin Franklin did, that in any democracy, when the people can vote for themselves a piece of the coffer, it can be the end of a republic, because they'll figure out that they can vote for themselves a paycheck. And when we look at our society and see 47 million people on food stamps, we see Franklin's fears embodied. And so that dielectric is where we're sitting. We're sitting at a point where we have, for all intents and purposes, a professional voter class in which the people fear that we have seen the last free election in our country.
Well, we're at a turning point, if that's true, where if you accept that proposition by Franklin, we're at a turning point right now, because right now what's going on in Washington is we're struggling with trying to reconcile these huge deficits against the entitlement programs and the other things that have brought them about. So now is really the time to be involved. Now is really the time to make your voice heard, because this is going to be a crucial period in turning that around. And it's true that people in a democracy represent, you know, they vote their own self-interest. That's the first thing we teach people in politics when we go out and campaign. I teach people about campaigning all the time. And Tip O'Neill used to say, all politics is local. And we say that. We say that all politics is local, and the people that get elected are the people that are seen as the people that deliver the goods. So you're right. People vote their own self-interest, but that's the way the system's supposed to work. It's supposed to be that I vote my self-interest and you vote your self-interest, and that the extremes cancel each other out and push policies towards the middle. And that's how it's supposed to work, but it doesn't always work that way because we're not all engaged.
Yeah, that's exactly right. More players show up on one side than on the other.
Right.
In the middle, both from a policy point of view and a philosophical point of view, is the space where the people are empowered to produce for themselves. It's often said, we don't need more taxes, we need more taxpayers. And I don't know anybody out there that doesn't have a job that doesn't want to go to work. They want to find some place to get a job. And if they can't get a job, they'll make a job. They'll form their own company. They'll cut grass. They'll cut hair. They'll paint houses. They'll do nails. Whatever it takes to make a living for their family. And then you have another group of people who believe that if they can't make it on their own, then the government should take care of them. And I fear that faction of our society has lost hope to the point where they feel that's their only source of revenue, their only choice.
Well, we certainly see that in again, if we look at Washington, D.C., as an example, the District of Columbia, we see that in our poor neighborhoods, we have a jobless rate, an unemployment rate of in excess of 30%. Whereas in my neighborhood, the neighborhood that I live in, which is one of the wealthier neighborhoods in Washington, D.C., we have an unemployment rate of 7%. So, not only is, you know, your point well taken that people are feeling this, but it's actually becoming a self-fulfilling reality.
Sure.
They really are. You know, we really are reaching a point in some of these communities where hopelessness abounds more than the spirit that you talked about earlier, the entrepreneurial spirit. You know, that's certainly one of the things that's made America great, isn't it? The freedom for us to succeed. And that's what democracy is supposed to be about. It's not supposed to be about providing you with a living. It's supposed to be about providing you with the opportunity, with equal opportunity.
Yeah, there you go.
And as those opportunities get smaller, then that reality that you're talking about, takes over, that people do give up. You know, we talk about unemployment. Unemployment is now going down. But it doesn't include all the people that have forgotten, you know, who have given up, who don't look for jobs anymore.
Sure.
And that's a new phenomenon. I've been through economic. I'm 59 years old. I've been through several hard economic times. But I've never seen such widespread disillusionment as I've seen in recent years. And I agree with you. I find that very disturbing.
Well, you know, we're about the same age. I haven't been in politics. I've been in manufacturing my whole life. And I heard in our industry an interesting statistic this week, and that is we hit the low of 12 million manufacturing jobs now working in America. That's where we were in 1961.
Yeah.
That's a long time to not be making stuff. We should be building stuff in this country. I drive by industrial parks with one factory working and 16, 18 buildings empty. Every yep. single one of those buildings should be full of people making stuff. Yep. What's going on?
Well, you know, I think that we're not keeping up with a changing world, and that we need to change our focus. And we also, I think we need, like I say, I think we need to engage more. We need to, you know, there used to be a thing that I felt growing up, and I don't know, let's call it being an American, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. But there was a core set of principles, it seems to me, that we all agreed on, that I'm not sure we agree on anymore. And I think that's a problem. You know, when America, in the history of this country, when we've been faced with great crisis, regardless of our differences, we've been able to pull together and move the country forward. And we see that today still. You know, certainly 9/11 was an indicator that the same spirit that got us through the First World War and the Second World War and the Depression and those other hard times in American history is still present. But we need to, I don't think it's on the surface as much as it used to be when I was younger.
I couldn't agree more. It's not necessarily the patriotism. You know,
right.
that can also not be a good thing. But
right.
it is that American rise to meet the challenge. You know,
exactly
it's sort of
right.
like they said we couldn't do what?
Right, that's exactly right. And that has really been the hallmark of America, and that's why America is a light onto the world. It's not just, you know, because we've always had that spirit, and we've always met those challenges. And I think we can still do it, but I think that we need to... But I think things are changing. You know, it's like gun control. Gun control is a big issue right now. And I'm one of those people that believes in gun control, in tougher gun control laws. But I'm also a kid that grew up in a working-class neighborhood where I always had access to a gun. And all my friends had access to guns. But none of us went out, or had we ever heard of anybody going out and massacring people in high schools and you know, because we were depressed or you know, we didn't like society. Something, it's not just the guns, you know what I mean? Something has changed in our mentality that's made America a different place than it was 50 years ago.
Oh, there's no question about that. And I don't think a high capacity magazine has anything to do with that. I totally agree
well,
with you.
Well, not that aspect of it. No, I don't think it does. I think there is certainly a mentality out there that was different. I mean, you would have never heard of these things 50 years ago, the kind of things Virginia Tech or the shootings in Connecticut or Aurora or the thing in Arizona with Gabby Giffords, all those kind of things. I mean, we never heard of those things.
No, we haven't. And even today, even in this environment, there are probably 50 or even 100 stories where guns saved a household from being robbed or saved a store from being robbed or were instrumental in apprehending someone who was violent and breaking the law. But we don't hear about those in the press because that doesn't push the agenda. For 375 years, there have been armed Americans. And the original idea behind it, even Jefferson and the rest of the founding fathers, was that an armed American is a deterrent against an oppressive government. It had nothing to do with hunting or crime or anything like that. It was just that's the deterrent against an oppressive government.
That's certainly the interpretation of the Second Amendment by the National Rifle Association, but I would tell you that it is my opinion that Jefferson never meant anybody to protect themselves from an oppressive government, because the people that wrote the Constitution actually saw the government as themselves. The Second Amendment starts a well-regulated militia being essential to the freedom of the state. It really is about keeping America free and armed residents protecting the government, not protecting themselves from the government. And that's one of the things. That's one of the things that's changed in the way we think. We think people think they need to be protected from the government, and that's just a fallacy. They don't need to be protected from the government, especially not with arms.
Well, that's interesting. I never thought about that perspective and hadn't heard it before. So that's interesting. I'll have to think about that for a while.
The reality of it is, look, if you think that the government wants to get you, there's no gun that's going to protect you. I lived across the street from the Marine barracks. I can tell you, I don't care what kind of weapon you have, you're not going to be able to stand up to the United States Marines. So if the government wants you, they will get you, if that's really the way you think. But I think that's what's changed in America, that we don't see these things for protection anymore. And there are cases. Certainly, we just had a case here where that was absolutely true, where a man protected himself from a robber. Of course, unfortunately, we had another case where a young boy climbed in, a teenager got drunk and climbed into the wrong house, climbed through a window in the wrong house and was shot by somebody who was afraid and told him to stop, and he didn't stop. And, of course, it wasn't the homeowner's fault in that case, but it was just a tragic accident. So that goes both ways. But I think the mentality about why we want to be armed has changed. And I think beyond guns, that's also our attitude about the government these days. We have a bad attitude about government, and we need to change that, I think. But the way we change that is by engaging.
I couldn't agree more, and I think it's all healthy dialogue. Let's talk about energy for a little bit. D.C. is one of the bright spots at night, certainly uses a lot of energy, and there's certainly a lot of brilliant inventors out there who have lots of ideas for making energy more efficient or even generating or storing electricity for a rainy day. We see an effort by, I guess it's the NERC, the National Electrical Reliability Corporation, to centralize the power grid across the country so that we can move power from, say, Yuma, Arizona to New York if it needs to distribute that way. But that also has opened us up to some large liabilities, and that is physical and cyber attacks, pandemics, and natural disasters such as solar storms or tsunamis or whatever. What do you think should be done from a governmental point of view to provide a pathway for some of these other ideas that would either save or generate electricity to coming to market?
Well, I think that's fraught with peril. First of all, but it's important. first of all, let me tell you, you as a scientist, if you could invent a way to capture the hot air that comes out of the District of Columbia, especially on Capitol Hill, we could probably supply the energy needs for America for the next 100 years. But until we develop a way to do that, I think we have to foster as much as we can new technologies. You know, we have to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels if we can. You know, in the District of Columbia, we're trying to do that. Our goal is to make the district the greenest city in America by the year 2020. And so there have been new regulations. Most of them have dealt with passive ways to save energy in the District of Columbia. So now all the new buildings that we're building that are D.C. government buildings have green roofs. You know, they're environmentally very often they have grass or other types of vegetation on them that helps cool the roof and helps protect it and does energy is not my strong point, but I think we need to do that. I think we also need to develop continue to develop domestic sources of energy. I know that fracking has become big in North Dakota and Ohio and Pennsylvania. There are a lot of environmental concerns about it, and we need to be very, very sensitive to those concerns. But I think we also need to pursue what energy resources are available to us. But I think the government needs to continue to provide incentives for people to be, more fuel efficient and more. I drive a car now that gets 32 miles to a gallon of gas, and there's nothing special about it. But the car that I had 10 years ago got 10 miles less a gallon.
Yeah.
So I think we need to keep, you know, the pressure on to get those numbers up, and I think we need to explore new energy resources that may be available to us, and we need to feed new technology. You know, there should be incentives for people that are willing to go into solar and wind and other alternative types of energy. You know, but we saw what could happen with Solyndra. We saw what a disaster that was.
Well, I understand that, and I see those kinds of poster children of a financial disaster being used by both sides to bludgeon one another. And, you know, the cylinders are going to happen. People that
right,
have hundreds of millions of dollars invested in something, you can't blame them. They're going to go to Washington. They're going to lobby hard. They're going to make promises. And eventually they're going to get some funding, which is going to embarrass somebody. But there are a lot of smaller venues, certainly less than $10 million, that would greatly help some of these conservation, storage, and even generation technologies. Not high voltage stuff, but low voltage stuff to help a home or a hospital or a school or someplace have its own power supply so that in the case of a power outage, they can continue essential services. But there's no funding available for any of that, certainly not through the banks or investors, because ostensibly there's no market for it yet. So, historically, we've always looked to government to be sort of the risk partner. And yet I hear conservatives say, well, that's not the business of government. But you make a very good point that now we have more cars on the road than we've ever had before, and yet our oil usage as a nation has been flat for about 10 years and is projected to be flat for another 20 years by the Department of Transportation.
Right.
Because although there are more cars, they get better mileage.
Well, and as the environment changes, we need to keep up with that, too. You know, I was, for many, many years, for 25 years, I ran a political consulting firm that dealt mostly in the area of direct mail. Well, 20 years ago, there was a serious paper shortage in the world. We were chopping down trees, adding to global warming, at a record pace. But all that slowed because of the Internet. The Internet has reduced the consumption of paper in America by 50%. So now there are more trees. There are, you know, I mean, we also have to be sensitive, and it's hard sometimes for government to adjust to those things because government is so large, and it really is in our best interest to feed those little businesses that you're talking about that are less than 10 million, because those guys do adjust. They adjust immediately, and they really are a great hope for the future. You know, we all know that. We all laugh at when government does something, right? It always takes more time and more money and more, you know. They're never as efficient as business. So I think it's a very legitimate role for the government to step in those areas and help with the risk with smaller companies that can't afford to do it themselves. I think we all have a vested interest in that.
I couldn't agree more. The only observation that I make is so far government has done a pretty poor job of doing that. They have bent to the global multinational corporations pretty well. You know, bailouts or low interest loans or whatever. That at least is a support that's there. But as far as the small business who or the inventor who files a patent that says, you know, I can get energy from the vibrations of the earth. I don't know, energy from 0 point, let's call it. And I can produce 3 kilowatts, enough to run one house with a grid that goes under the shingles of your house or something. But they never can get any funding to build a prototype. I look at the NERC, which is going to go through $200 billion in the next 5 years to address these three risks I mentioned. But there's less than, and I'm going to say since 2009, there's been less than $2 billion spent in green energy in the United States as far as venture capital investment. That's an embarrassment for a country of our intellectual and technological standing. We should be spending way more than that, bringing these technologies to the forefront.
Well, that's absolutely true, and government is slow. I mean, that's why in the big government, let's call it the big government battle, you know, between communism and democracy and capitalism. Democracy and capitalism always wins out, right? Because you can't plan an economy. It's always those small people. It's always that competition. It's always those innovative people that make the difference. You know, if you try to plan an economy like they did in the Soviet Union, it's always a disaster. So we know for a fact that feeding the small people is in the inventors and our educational institutions and those people that have their, you know, for lack of a better term, their ear to the economic rail is always in our best interest. And I think we need to do a better job of that. And again, the more we engage voters in that battle, the better off we are. Because the big companies, you know, as an individual, you can't compete with them. We also need to get the money out of politics. I mean, that, you know, big corporations don't, and labor unions and other entities don't give millions and millions of dollars to politicians because they're not getting anything in return.
That's true.
You know, I mean, they're just not doing it out of the kindness of their heart. They're doing it because it's a good investment.
Yeah. Well, speaking of investment, I was speaking with former Secretary of Education Bill Bennett not long ago, and he asked me, you know, everybody's asking the question and we can't find the answer, what do we do to kickstart the economy? How do we get the economy moving again? And I said, Dr. Bennett, there's two things you have to do first as government. It won't cost a dime of taxpayer money. If you don't do this, we don't have a prayer. We're never going to recover. He said, well, what is it? I said, the first thing you have to do is you've got to invite that $5.5 trillion of capital that's sitting on the sidelines in America back into the business of business. And the way you do that is you eliminate or greatly reduce the capital gains tax on investments in market cap companies less than $50 million. You have to do it, or they're never going to invest. And the second is just as important as the first, and if you don't do it, the first won't work. And that is, you have to stop the naked short traders from dumping phantom shares on the market. You do that by putting it automatic in the program that when they fail to deliver a stock at the end of business, they can't trade the next day. That will stop the phantom share market. Now, it's already illegal, but there haven't been any prosecutions in years and years and years. And what it's effectively done is it's destroyed over 8,000 publicly traded small businesses by driving their stocks to the point where they're worthless and they delist. The companies can't raise any more money because these naked short traders are dumping billions of shares on the market at a tenth of their value to drive these companies out of business. If you could do those two things, you don't need any more government programs. Small business will raise their own money from their own investors, and they will take off on their own.
Well, you know, in addition to that, large government has helped destroy confidence in these markets by constantly pulling these guys out. You know, when you've got a situation where you've loaned hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayers' money to a corporation like AIG, and then the first thing they do is they turn around and pay massive bonuses to their employees, you have ruined the confidence that people who invest have in these markets. And I mean little guys, not the big
sure.
Wall Street traders. The people that you're talking about that are manipulating the markets will always be there. But rank and file Americans, they don't trust it anymore.
Well, that's why you have to restrict this to market cap companies of less than $50 million.
Yeah.
That way you don't have AIG writing insurance wraps for derivatives that from banks that are writing financial instruments on phantom payments that haven't been made yet.
Right. And isn't that the saddest thing, that Americans have to face that and have to pull these guys out when they realize that if they're in that position, there's nobody there to help them.
That's true.
They not only bailed out the savings and loan, they not only bailed out the guys on Wall Street, but then they let all those bogus loans come due, and who paid for that? The American people. They
sure.
paid for it in their taxes, and they paid for it in losing their homes.
Sure. But when you have a small business that's doing everything right, they have their intellectual property, they've got their friends and family to invest, they started up the company, now they're ready to go public, they go public, they raise $50, $60 million, they buy a building, they buy equipment, they start manufacturing, and then the naked short traders dump 40 million shares on the market at a penny apiece. They lose their complete loan base and they go out of business. They didn't do anything wrong.
Right. Well, and you know, and when you look again at the history of America, the Sherman Antitrust Act established a long time ago that it is the appropriate role for government to interfere with that type of activity, which gives large investors that can manipulate the market an advantage over the rest of us. You know, it is a legitimate role of government to be involved in that. But, of course, that's why you need to get the money out of politics, because the same guys that are doing that are paying we have an old saying in Washington, we have the best politicians money can buy. So, you know, and that's sad. You got to get the money out of politics. And, you know, I'll tell you another thing, and I think this would be really controversial, but this would help a lot. You also should make every congressman in America should have a 4-year term. Shouldn't have a 2-year term. All these guys do is campaign.
Yeah.
And they pander to these people for the money to do it. If you gave them a 4-year term, so they didn't have to worry about doing a year's worth of legislation and then going out and campaigning for a year to get reelected, I think that would help things, and they would be more immune to the capital. I mean, when I worked for the Democratic National Committee. We ran a presidential campaign. There's a point in the presidential campaign where a presidential candidate can no longer raise money for themselves. Once they become the nominee of their party, then only the party can raise money for them. So when Romney got them the nomination, the RNC and his presidential campaign, I mean, the RNC was who funded his presidential campaign, the same thing with Obama and the DNC. We spent, I think, in the neighborhood of $80 million trying to get President Carter reelected. This last campaign, both campaigns spent over $1 billion.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And as long as they need $1 billion to win, money is going to have an influence on them. There's no way around it.
Yeah, you're right. Senator, let's go and take a phone call. We have Myron from Texas, line two. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I was listening to your conversation there, and I wanted to ask the senator a question going back to the employment, you know, and the jobs with the numbers that came out this past month. And I wanted to ask him, what do you think about the numbers that just came out, you know, seeing as how they've hired at the slowest pace in nearly a year, and with almost 500,000 people leaving the job market. I mean, what do you think about those numbers?
Well, I think that, you know, the 80-some thousand jobs that were just created last month, you know, was lower than they had anticipated given the prior months. So we're creating more jobs. Unemployment is lower than it's been in 6 years. But we're not creating them at a fast enough pace. I mean, it's obvious that there are a lot of people dropping out of the employment market, so this is a somewhat skewed number. But I think, to answer your question, I think the economy is headed in the right direction, but it's moving very slowly. And one of the things that concerns me most about this is this whole sequester thing, that we're now in gridlock on Capitol Hill, and we can't seem to come up with the right policies where we've compromised enough to move the economy forward. I'm worried that this is the worst time. As the economy starts to recover slowly, this is the worst time to be making massive cuts across the board indiscriminately. So that's what really worries me. I worry that the numbers that will come out in May and June and July may even be more disappointing.
Well, what do you think is a reasonable solution? I mean, if you don't want to have...
Well, I think a reasonable solution is that these guys got to get it together. You know, President Obama, for example, today or yesterday announced cuts in Social Security. This is the sacred cow of the Democratic Party, Social Security. So I think that now what conservatives need to do is they need to compromise and pass a budget. I think that both of them need to come together, and I think the president is lately showing some movement, and I think we now need to see congressional Republicans move in his direction, and we need to come up with a compromise soon to stop the sequester. I think the worst thing we can do as the economy struggles to get better is to make these massive cuts across the board. So now's the time for us to compromise. And the way we get people to compromise is we engage voters from across the country. You need to call your congressman and say, look, I believe that now is the time to come together, to work together so that our economy can get better. Because right now we've got a stalemate between the two sides.
Mm. Okay. Can I interject something here?
Yeah,
I think that the issue is maybe not in the mainstream news. This last month, about $1 trillion of investment money tried to move from European markets into U.S. markets. to invest equity into small business and could have started some 40,000 jobs in the last month. But that $1 trillion was held up by the IMF. And the reason that they gave, and I just found this out yesterday, the reason that they gave is they had to revalue that money based on the negative impact it would have on the European banks not being able to extend credit or invest in money markets. And they had to discount those deposits before they moved from Europe to the United States. And a lot of the investors didn't want their money discounted, so they just left it in Europe. But some of the investors, and I just found this out this morning, are willing to pay the IMF's discount, this revaluation adjustment that they're making, because they see such a huge opportunity in investing in equity in small business of America, and they're willing to move the money. And that's why you were 40,000 jobs short last month. You can blame that on the IMF, because the money tried to move and couldn't.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thanks, Myron. Our phone line.
That's right. I think that, you know, we're so that's just an externality of what's going on right now, Dr. Agnew. I think that the fact is they're so locked into this battle over some issues that shouldn't even be on the table right now.
Exactly.
That there's probably lots of opportunities that are being squandered while these guys stand toe to toe and get in a fight on Capitol Hill over who's going to win. And I think it's, you know, I think that both sides have to take responsibility. I think both sides are at fault. And I think they, you know, it's time for the American people to stand up and say, you guys got to work together.
Yeah, because sequestration was never really designed to take place. It was
right.
A motivation to stop kicking the can down the road and get to work. And what happened was, I don't know why both sides couldn't come together a year ago, but they didn't. And we reached the deadline and this agreed upon guillotine called sequestration, which is really an indiscriminate rollback of increases of budgets in several different areas, which, you know, budgets always go up every year. One of those is the Pentagon. I was actually in the Pentagon not long ago, and it's a somber feeling there. That,
yes.
You know,
oh,
meeting,
absolutely.
You're in a meeting with 25 individuals, and somebody says, you realize next month a third of us won't be here.
Right. That's exactly right. And you know, I mean, you're absolutely right about sequestration. And, you know, what it reminds me of is, like, the threats I make to my children that are unreasonable. I think every parent can, you know, like when they're 7 years old and you're on the car trip and they've been fighting in the back seat and you go, if you touch your sister one more time, I'm going to rip your arms off. That kind of thing. You're trying to give them something so scary that they won't even think. But then when they touch their sister again, you know.
You compromise.
They can't rip their arms off. You know,
yeah,
so I think that's exactly what happened with sequestration is they tried to make it so scary that nobody would come to that point, but now they've come to that point. So now they've got to stand up and man up, if you'll excuse the sexist allegory, and come to a compromise.
One of my best listeners just texted me a question, and it's a good one. She picked up on the fact that I mentioned revaluation of currency. And the average American watches these banks and these big investors like Soros who invest in various currencies, you know, the yen and the euro, and they hedge and they move back and they make billions in the process. Well, we watched in Kuwait during the first Gulf War, we watched the Kuwaiti dinar be pulled off the market because Saddam Hussein had come in and stolen so much. They issued a new dinar, revalued it, issued it to the market, and investors that were savvy enough and bought dinars made a huge amount of money. In the second Gulf War, The Iraqi dinar was also taken off the market, but it wasn't replaced. And so millions of Americans bought Iraqi dinars from their banks, and they've been sitting on them for 3, 4, 5 years. The rumor is that the Iraqi dinar is about to revaluate along with the Vietnamese go. If those two currencies revaluate, it is going to be like a lottery won across this country. You talk about an economic stimulus, and the U.S. Treasury is the biggest holder of Iraqi dinars. It's rumored about 1.2 trillion Iraqi dinars. Do you know anything, or have you heard anything in the halls of Congress about this currency or both currencies revaluating and what the budgets are going to do with that money?
No, I haven't. But I guarantee you, if what you're saying is true, that it works into the calculation of the negotiations that are going on right now. I mean, I haven't heard that, but these guys are right on. They're right on top of this sort of thing. So if this becomes a windfall, you can bet both sides are now working on how to best manipulate it. But
sure.
No, I haven't. I'm sorry. It's not an area in which I deal, so I really don't know much about it.
Okay. All right. I mean, it's not just the currency itself. Obviously, if the government cashed in 1.2 trillion Iraqi dinars, it would have a horrible inflationary effect. But if you got 5 million Americans that dump a trillion dinars, they have to pay taxes on it. So the government is going to make a windfall, to be sure. Plus, those people are going to go out and spend that money like crazy, like lottery winnings.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, these guys know how to spend money. It's saving money, they may not be very good at, but spending money, they're great at. I mean, I used to run a public interest group on Capitol Hill, and one of the things that we discovered were the $800 toilet seats that the Air Force was putting in planes and $750 screws that they were using. These guys really know how to waste money when they put their mind to it.
I remember a friend of mine who was a bulldozer operator in the hills above El Toro Marine Base, and they had some flood damage. They had really bad rains one summer, and they were up there recutting the roads because the Marines go up there and do maneuvers and all this stuff. So he was up there with the dozer, and part of the hillside had sloughed away, and he was pushing it off, you know, grading the road again. And he heard a loud crunch. And so he stopped the dozer thinking he'd run into something, you know, like a car or something under there. But it wasn't. It was a giant wooden shipping container, and he had busted it open with the blade of his bulldozer. And it was full of brand new chrome hammers. There must have been 200,000 hammers in this shipping container. So he grabbed a couple of them, rode his dozer down to the bottom of the hill, and said, hey, I crunched into this, and it's full of these brand new hammers. What can I do with them? And they said, nothing. You've got to go up there and rebury those hammers. Because if those hammers are dumped on the market, it will put the hardware business, you know, it'll impact the hardware. Those are paid for and buried and done. And there's no telling how much those hammers cost or how much of that stuff was buried in the hills above El Toro Marine Base.
Well, you know, there was a legendary legislator, Bob Byrd from West Virginia, senator from West Virginia. And it said that he got $3 back from the federal government for every dollar West Virginia paid in federal taxes. But at one point, there were warehouses full of hand grenades, which haven't been used by the military in years. I think they have things like rocket-propelled grenade launchers. But the kind of hand grenade you throw hasn't been used in decades. But it was built. They were made in West Virginia. And that's where Bob Byrd, a good Democratic senator, was from. And they kept on making them and stockpiling them, even though the federal government had no use for them. And then the federal government had another problem. They're explosive, and they had to get rid of them. So they were making millions of hand grenades while they were trying to get rid of them. It's just crazy sometimes. It's just crazy some of the things they do. We could go on. We could have a whole show on just government waste. You know, there used to be a guy named William Protzmeyer in the Senate, and every year he would give a thing called the Golden Fleece Award
for
that government program, which he thought wasted more money than, you know, in a stupid way than any other government program. And let me tell you, when you would see the list of nominations, it was hard to decide which one was the dumbest. There were so many dumb programs.
You know, somebody came on this program a couple of months ago and made a very effective case for a national sales tax, just a VAT tax. Do away with individual and even corporate income tax. Nobody pays it anyway accurately. And it's just used to manipulate the classes. And I said, well, that's all well and good, but, you know, what do you do with the IRS? What do you do with 275,000 employees? And they said, oh, that's easy. You employ the IRS to go after the waste in government. Let them go after the bureaucracies and start cutting the redundancies and the waste in government and get those.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting idea, seeing as their job in life is really to look for every nickel and dime. And to, you know, they might be really, really good at doing that. So that may be a great, that might be a great use for them. Although I'm sure it would scare bureaucrats everywhere, you know. And it's a problem. You know, it's a problem in politics. We lost a city council member in the District of Columbia who resigned, and on his first day of work as chairman of the city council, he ordered two Lincoln Navigators, even though he wasn't supposed to have a city car. He ordered a Lincoln Navigator at a ridiculous cost. I forget what it was. And it didn't come with the right interior, the right color interior, so he ordered another one.
Wow.
This is a constant problem in politics.
Well, I mean, D.C. has the top-selling Lamborghini dealership, the top-selling Ferrari dealership, and the top-selling Mercedes dealership in the nation.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
I mean, that's it's not... And actually, this article was a slam on the money in politics. But I said, no. That's not necessarily true, because D.C. has the highest educated populace in the country. There are more PhDs and master's degrees in D.C. than any place else in the country. These are smart people, and they're making huge amounts of money doing global business. And that's where that. That's where the Ferraris come from. I guarantee you that if you go to the parking lot of the Pentagon, you won't see a single Lamborghini in that parking lot. Not one.
Well, that's true. Unless the defense contractors using their own cars are coming over to take people to lunch. But yes, that's true. I have every year I ride to the wall with the Vietnam veterans from on my Harley. In fact, I'm getting so old that it's the one time a year that I take my Harley out. But I spend a lot of time on the parking lot of the Pentagon. That's where we all gather. But that's true. For the most part, people in Washington are wealthy. That's why we pay the highest per capita income taxes. So there's a lot of truth to that. But for the most part in Washington, we're a community like most other communities. You know, teachers, doctors, lawyers.
Sure.
You know, small businessmen.
Physicists.
There's an indigenous population here that people sometimes don't recognize because of all the other stuff in politics around it.
Exactly. Well, I want to let everybody know. I know we got a full audience tonight. I know they're not calling in because they're listening, but Senator Michael Brown is going to be launching his own one-hour radio program every Sunday night at 4 p.m. Pacific time, right here on the BBS radio network. So I encourage you, all of you, tune in 1 hour early and pick up the senator's radio program, because it's going to be you're talking directly to government when you're doing this. You're talking directly to the senator. You're not going through his secretary. You're not calling up his campaign office or his local office. You're talking straight to the senator. This is a very rare opportunity for free press, uninterrupted by commercial breaks. So I encourage
you
to do that.
Dr. Agnew, and I think that's right. We want to start a dialogue. We want to hear from people, because again, you know, I hate to keep on going back to my friend Tom Jefferson, but he said the most important title that anybody can have in a democracy is that of citizen. So I can't express to people how important their voice is. And that's really what this show will attempt to do, is to give a voice to the voiceless, because we all need to be involved in this dialogue.
One of my listeners wrote me in and has reminded me of my remiss. This week there was a very controversial vote, or not maybe in a vote. It was some kind of act or an executive order that was put out. What it did, it blocked anybody from suing Monsanto for the fallout from genetically modified organisms. And they were wondering why that was done. What was the purpose for protecting Monsanto from liability for these genetically modified foods? Do you know?
No, I don't. And I can tell you that Monsanto is – well, I can tell you that Monsanto puts a lot of money into politics. That's you know, you know, if you're asking me to hazard a guess – I would say that has something to do with it, but and they're a major corporation. But I know on other areas, you know, and other things that they've done, they haven't been protected. They've been sued for some of the products they've made over the years because of the consequences. So I'm not really sure why they would protect. Why would they protect them on this particular issue? I really don't know. But, well, you know, there's all sorts of special legislation that comes out all the time. I don't know if you've read during the when the sequester started, about the special provisions they give people that own private planes. You know, and they're you know, how much of a tax write-off people get that own private planes. It's just ridiculous compared to, we don't get to write off our cars or other types of transportation, but there was special legislation passed to exempt, you know, to give tax breaks to this specific group. And that happens all the time.
Yeah, but that tax break comes under the Part 179, because those planes are used more than 50% for business and business travel. And a lot of executives, and I do business with them off and on, they try to take public transportation, and it just kills the whole day. If you want to fly from Detroit to Charlotte, you know, it's an 11-hour drive. It's an hour and 25-minute flight. Well, that's fine. But what if your meeting runs long and then you have to postpone your ticket? Well, now you just added $150 to the price of the ticket. And when you're moving four or five people from Detroit down to Charlotte, it's just as cheap to charter a jet and land at Concord. And that way you can leave when you want to leave. And Concord Airport, which is right across the street from my plant, it's one of the busiest corporate airports on the Eastern Seaboard. It just blazes with corporate jets all the time. But, you know, Charlotte's the banking center of the Southeast, so you can expect it. So those Part 179 deductions are legitimate, and certainly the loopholes.
Well, they are legitimate.
Cut out.
But
so,
it's a matter of what constitutes a special group, and they certainly, those businessmen certainly constitute a special group. And you can argue that that is an appropriate thing. There are some people that are arguing that it's inappropriate. But all the time we make laws in Washington, D.C., that affect just small groups of people. And in general, the government, although it has a right to do that, they even have an interest in doing it in certain industries. We all have the home mortgage deduction, for example, which was instituted in an effort to, because we felt that the country had a vested interest in promoting home ownership. But as you probably heard recently, that's coming under attack.
Yeah, but people forget it's the construction of the homes that it encourages. Look at all the payroll taxes that are paid by all the people that built that home and maintained that home, all the air conditioning people and the plumbers and electricians and painters. They all pay payroll taxes, which more than offsets that mortgage deduction.
That's right, and we still do that all the time. We in Washington, D.C., for example, we spent I think it was $40 million to build a baseball stadium for a baseball team. The government paid for it because they generate so much in tax revenue from the games that we wanted the team in the District of Columbia. So, I mean, government does this all the time to provide incentives for industry. So I don't know if that had to do with it or not, but...
You've got to look at the balance sheet. I mean, by the way, the Nationals are a great baseball team. We'd love to see them.
Yeah, these days they are.
Yeah. and let's not get away from this Monsanto thing too much because the chat is just streaming right now. People are saying that they have effectively legislated organic farms out of business by incentivizing Monsanto. Whole Foods has been bought out. People cannot buy organically grown foods on a large scale now because of this legislation. And they feel there's a risk.
Well, there may be. And I can tell you, although I'm not familiar with the Monsanto case, I did cover PL 480 when I was in graduate school, which is the farm bill. And farmers in this country get huge subsidies, and the people that benefit most from those subsidies are the large corporate farmers, not the small, little family-owned farms. You know, it's funny when you go into these hearings; they always bring in some farmer from North Carolina whose family has run the same 1,000-acre farm or 500-acre farm for three generations, and they talk about how important subsidies are to keep that farmer alive. And that may very well be true, but the people that really make the money, the people that cash in on the farm subsidies, are the corporate farmers that own millions and millions of acres in Texas and Oklahoma and, throughout the Midwest. So the farm lobby has gotten money from, for forever from the federal government. They're one of the heaviest subsidized, and like I say, the larger guys make the most out of it. So it doesn't surprise me that it's hard for organic farmers to survive, or any small farmer to survive.
You made the best point by saying we need to get the money out of politics.
Yeah.
This is the kind of money we got to get out of politics. These Monsanto billions that are being pushed into the bureaucracies and into politics are exactly why the organic food industry is an endangered species.
Yes. And the way we replace the money in politics is we got to replace it with people. You know, people need to be engaged. People need to be involved. People need to, when you talk about something like campaign finance reform, which Senator McCain and Senator Feingold both tried to institute a decade ago, people's eyes glaze over, and they don't understand some of the technical issues, and they don't want to be involved. But this is so important. Because there's just no way that you're going to take a $50,000 campaign contribution from somebody, I can tell you, as a politician, and then not pick up the phone when they call.
I just had an amazing text from a listener who commends you for your leadership and for hosting your own radio show. She thinks that we need a regulation where all government representatives should be required to host a weekly call-in program on the radio.
Well, that's a great idea. And we know now, you know, there's a TV spot once a week for a message from the President of the United States. And I guess this started a long time ago with FDR's fireside chats and stuff. But, yes, there ought to be these guys ought to report back to the people at every opportunity. Because
and not
you
just
never
report,
forget that's
interact.
Who you work for. I'm sorry.
And not just report, but also interact. Take phone calls.
Yes, interact.
I mean,
yes.
Screen them, because otherwise you'll have people shouting all kinds of weird stuff. They don't on this program, but
what?
We have a good screener out in Paradise, California, who's pretty good. But be able to listen to what people are saying. Like my screen is just lit up with people writing in from all over the country saying, ask the senator this, ask the senator that. That's exactly the kind of interaction you're going to see on your program next week at 4 o'clock Pacific time.
And you know, we people in Washington, we get so out of touch. And I'll tell you, on my show, we're going to have I'm going to have a colleague, just a friend of mine that I've known for years with tons of political experience, named Kathleen Gomez. But Kathleen lives in a little town in Arizona, and she's a single mom with two sons, even though she's worked for many congressmen and worked for the president, and she's got a lot of experience. Now she's a single mom in Douglas, Arizona, with two kids. And, you know, I think it's important to have that perspective, because we get so isolated in Washington. It's just incredible. It's amazing how out of touch we get, especially politicians, because they're surrounded by people that are always telling them how wonderful they are.
Yeah. Well, they should realize that most of the constituency out here that cares enough to interact with politics has a perspective, has a story that's a street-level story of how a regulation has affected their lives, or how a national policy has affected their lives. And it's that kind of feedback, because you guys are double insulated. First of all, you draft the legislation, you argue it out, you pass it, but then it's handed off to the agencies, bureaus, departments, and administrations, and they write the regulations to implement that law.
Right.
But you don't get to read those regulations. You can't interact with those regulations. In fact, it's illegal for you to go to a bureaucracy with a constituent on an individual project. That I found
out.
Right. A lot of people don't know that. What do you mean? They're the Congress. They should be able to go to them. No,
right.
They can't. It's illegal. You can't do it. So the only way you found out about it is if we, the constituents, go back to you, the senator, and say, hey, this is really impacting my small business that manufactures, you know, windshield wiper motors or whatever. That's the kind of feedback that you guys need.
That's exactly right. And that's really the major problem with our problem here in D.C. with statehood. 79% of people don't understand that we're not the same, so nobody makes any noise about it. You can go up on Capitol Hill and say to any congressman or senator, look, we pay the highest federal income taxes. We have 35 Congressional Medal of Honor winners from the District of Columbia. We've fought in every war. We've given up we've had over 200,000 people serve during combat during wartime, and every single member will say to you, "Oh yeah, you deserve the same rights as everybody else," but we're not going to help you get them. So people need to be engaged because they need to hold these guys' feet to their feet to the fire, and they also need to inform them. You're absolutely right, because they don't know what's going on. It's we are very detached here. And I can tell you a good example. This is a good story from PL 480, which was the Farm Bill. I also worked on the breakup of the phone company. And the phone company would bring in, they wanted to break up AT&T in a specific way. And they actually led the members of Congress down the path they wanted to go because they had the expertise. They would bring in people that were Nobel Prize winners that worked for Bell Labs, and they would testify against kids from the Sierra Club. So when business is the only voice they hear, it's really not necessarily an insidious thing. It's just that they don't get any they're not getting feedback from any other sources.
Well, how do we, the people, how do small businesses like mine and others gain access to Congress to be able to sit at those 6-foot tables at the microphone and say, Senator, Congressman, this is how this is impacting me? Because you can't. We do it with the bureaucracies. We'll do it with the Department of Energy or with the Department of Transportation, and they will read a regulation one way, and we'll read it another way, and we believe we're reading it literally the way the regulation's written, but they interpret it differently. Things like financial capability, you know, the financial capability clause, and every agency's got one. They will just make up things. Like they'll say, well, you got to put up a $2 million letter of credit in order to qualify to sell to the government. What? Where's a small business going to get a $2 million letter of credit? We just want to sell it to our government. We want to sell our widgets. We want to sell our T-shirts or our pencil erasers. Why should we have to put up a letter of credit? Well, that's the financial capability clause. But that's not
what you know. It's not an easy thing to do, but you need to organize and band together. If you take, the easiest examples of this are not necessarily from business, but they're from social, political groups. Like take a group like Mothers Against Drunk Drivers.
Sure.
Here's a group of people that were organized by a couple of mothers who had lost children, and they organized themselves and band together and got people from around the country to join, and they've changed the laws in all 50 states. There's not a state in the United States that doesn't have tougher drunk driving laws today because of what those women did.
I agree with that. I totally agree with that. But it cost those two women years of their lives. They had to raise millions of dollars.
Yes,
and that's the level they had to go to get noticed by their legislators.
Yes,
lots of small businesses don't have the time or money to divert away from what it is they're trying to do every day and feed their employees with paychecks to go do a lobbying effort like that. In fact, most small businesses and most nonprofits are prohibited by statute from lobbying Congress. But
well,
we should have access.
Well, you know, it might interest you to know that we found out through our lobbying efforts that sometimes as few as 30 phone calls will get a congressman or senator's attention on an issue. So in other words, when you call your congressman, not many people do this, believe it or not, but when you call your congressman and say, hi, I'm Dr. Agnew and I'm a constituent of yours and I really care about what's this legislation with Monsanto and the effect that it's going to have on organic farmers, there's some little girl there or guy that's answering the phone, and he's got a little sheet in front of him or her, and he's marking that off. Dr. Agnew, Monsanto. You get 30 phone calls about Monsanto, And that's enough to get that guy to look into it.
Well, I understand that. And I have, you know, been to the Congressional Auditorium and spoken to the Secretary of Transportation and Nancy Pelosi and Dennis Kucinich. And they listen in that venue, but it doesn't seem like anything gets done. They know the regulations are out there choking small businesses to death with meaningless labeling and all kinds of regulations that do nothing. They don't save lives. They don't make money. They don't protect any particular industry. And yet we have to conform with them. And in some cases, it takes millions of dollars for us to conform with something so simple as a label that goes on the inside of a car door.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I certainly feel your pain about this, Dr. Agnew. I can tell you that I used to run, this is my favorite one of those stories, is I used to run a public interest organization, and one of the programs that we worked on was WIC, and WIC is Women, Infants, and Children. You know, it's a nutrition program for prenatal care for women and for small children. So we did a report, and there was a government regulation that said that all references to sex in the report had to be gender neutral. Mm-hmm. And we actually got a letter from the federal government that they want us to change in our report the reference to pregnant women and call them pregnant persons.
Oh, very good. Like there'd be some other than a
woman.
And
that was, we loved it. We of course, we never had to do that. We wrote back explaining to the stupid bureaucrat that sent us the letter that we felt since there is no such, since pregnancy would be one of the things that defined you as a woman, since we've never, ever found a case of a pregnant man, that we were well within our right to do that, and it came under some other clause that, you know, of exclusive gender identification. But we blew up the letter and we put it on the wall because it was the classic kind of government, right? Pregnant people.
I totally agree with you. And you know, as you launch your own radio program next week. I'm going to tune in, and hopefully I'm a guest on the program from time to time.
Yeah, I'll get you. We're going to do an introductory program where we just explain what's going on, and then we'll hope that in the following few weeks you'll come on.
Yeah. It's not that, you know, we're politically correct here at X Squared Radio, and we do cover very controversial subjects, but we always try to look for solutions. We're not trying to blame anybody. We're not trying to get anybody out of office. What we're looking for is a way for government to govern. And sometimes we feel that they rule.
Well, we need more of that in Washington. That's exactly what I'm talking about with this gridlock. That's what we should be doing. We shouldn't be pointing fingers at each other. We should say, look, America is in a tough spot right now with unemployment. Real unemployment, if you count all the people that are not looking for jobs anymore, closer to 10%. And all the other problems that we're having right now, we need to all pull together and move in the same direction and look for solutions and not point fingers. And, you know, part of the business of politics in Washington is the business of pointing fingers, and that has to stop.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Well, you've been very gracious in giving us.
There's nothing that I hate more as somebody that's worked on campaigns my whole life. There's nothing that I hate more than having politicians stand up there and say, I'm not as bad as the other guy.
Yeah, well.
And that's your rationale for voting for me. I'm not going to save you. I'm not going to come up with any new solution. I'm just not as bad. That other guy's a bum. You know, the negative advertising, I can tell you that when I started in politics in the 1970s, there wasn't the same kind of negative attacks there are today.
Well, yeah. And negative attacks, negative campaigning is effective. It's been proven to be effective.
Yes.
Look at all the pundits. That's exactly what they do.
Is.
But
unfortunately. And it's always been a part of American politics.
Me.
I mean, you know, as far back as Jefferson and you know, some of the early Andrew Jackson held the press responsible for his wife's death because they badgered her. You know, the it's always been a part of politics. Benjamin Franklin said some terrible things about people and vice versa. But never, in my experience, the way it is today, where you have whole campaigns that revolve around negative advertising and don't talk about solutions.
Well, the solutions are there. And believe it or not, and I don't know what Washington feels about it, but the solutions are out here in the hinterland.
That's right. That's exactly where they are. That's why we want to do our show, because that's exactly where they are. Just like your economic solutions are often in the hands of small business, social solutions are also out there in the hands of the people. And, you know, and if we did a better job of listening and coalescing those opinions, I think we'd all be the better for it.
Well, there's no doubt about it. And going back, just recapping our 2 hours, and by the way, I really, really appreciate your gracious gift in giving us 2 hours of your busy time.
Thanks for having me.
The people have this kind of feeling that we have become enemies of the state, this whole gun control thing and money laundering and the Monsanto thing. It's big corporations run amok and that our government is starting to rule us instead of govern us.
Right.
And what you're doing with your radio program is definitely a step in the right direction. Speak and listen, and we can implement those solutions and those emotions, which really are the core of what makes us Americans. Not necessarily the skills with our hands, but our deep-rooted patriotism and belief in the freedom of this country. This is where you're going to hear the truth out here.
Well, and you know what? I've spent a long time in politics, and I've heard every opinion that you can imagine. But I've never, ever, ever once heard anybody say, "I regret being an American." We all understand, I think, every last one of us, how lucky we are to be in a country where you can do the kind of things that you and I are doing right now without worrying about retribution from the government, where you do have great freedom and you do have secured liberties and you do have a common sense of purpose. I think we all realize that. To be born in America is a gift.
Well, I believe that, and no matter which side of whatever aisle you think you're on, and I think politician, every government official that I've spoken to believes that. The closest thing I ever heard to somebody saying the opposite of that would be, I guess it'd be the First Lady when she said, you know, I'm finally – becoming proud of my country. And well, she's not a politician, you know, otherwise she would have couched that a little more carefully, but
I think that's probably the case. She misspoke.
No one understands the anathema of prejudice more than Americans. We're probably one of the only nations in the world to have fought a terrible, bloody war over that internally, brother to brother, to solve that issue once and for all.
That's right. That's right. And this year actually is the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. We celebrated in the district. Here's a little fact since you brought this up that a lot of people probably don't know, but we have one holiday we're getting ready for. It's April 16th. We have one holiday in the District of Columbia that's an official holiday, and that's Emancipation Day, because 9 months before Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, he freed all the slaves in the District of Columbia. He bought 3,400 slaves and set them free. So this is our big holiday in the district. We used to have a parade that involved the president every year, but the holiday lapsed for a while, and about 20 years ago somebody brought it back. So we celebrate it every year, and that's what we celebrate, is the fact that we were the first place in the nation to free the slaves, and this is part of the character of Washington, D.C. It's almost ironic that we were the first to free the slaves and we're last to be freed ourselves.
Well, it's a terrible blight on the entire world that one human being would be oppressed by another human being that way. In some respects, you know, even out here today, we still feel the same thing. You feel a separation from the rest of the country being in Washington all the time. We definitely feel separated from Washington by some of the rhetoric and some of the things that we hear and the regulations that we hear. I think just yesterday we heard that individual IRAs are going to be limited to $3 million, and I have a lot of friends that have more money than that in there. I would have more money in that if I hadn't sold it and paid off all my debts. And I'm not a wealthy person. I'm just very religious about putting in my money, and my employer matched my investment, and it was worth more than that. So this is the suspicion, and you're going to hear it when you start your radio program.
That's good, because we need to get this dialogue out there. You know, I think that it's not only the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, and I think I've tried to make that point tonight, that you need to be a squeaky wheel, but it's also the people with money in politics that get what they want, and we need to step up to the plate and try to counter that. And the way to counter that is to get involved. Votes. There's two things that matter to these guys, and one is money, and the other is votes.
Well, that's true, but this is where you find the voters out here. You're doing the
right thing.
You're coming out. By the way, I totally support your four-year term idea. I wrote a book about it, and it's a smart idea. It's long overdue. Get the congressman out of campaign mode all the time.
Yeah.
We're a modern society, and you know congressmen are going to serve more than one term anyway, unless they can't find their way to the restroom or something. They're going to serve more than one term. But let's get them out of campaign mode.
I'm sorry, Dr. Aiken. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, if you get them out of campaign mode, at least that puts the lobbyists and the special interest groups out of business half the time.
That's right. Well, and you know what? We have to make politicians understand that what happens when they don't do these things, when they don't respond to the people, is that they suffer too. You know, in Virginia, we have a law that you can only serve as governor one term.
There's another thing, term limits. I mean, where do
term
we go?
Limits. That's right. And when you think about term limits, you say, look, every congressman has a 2-year term limit. So what are we saying when we say we want term limits? We're saying we hate these guys, they're no good, but we keep on reelecting them, so please protect us from ourselves. It's because we don't really want to, you know, we really don't want to take the time it takes to understand what the politics are sometimes and get these guys out. But we, you know, so politicians have to understand, too, that when they don't respond appropriately to people, they get laws like term limits, because people get frustrated and they say, well, we can't figure out any way to get them out, so let's just legislate them out.
Well, you know, to say we have automatic term limits because people could just vote in someone else, it's not that easy. Once you're a constituent, once you're a person that's already in office, you have the ability as the incumbent to beat a challenger most of the time. A challenger
can raise the money.
Yeah, a challenger has to raise a lot of money, because he doesn't have the pulpit that an incumbent does. Now, that doesn't really apply in the executive branch, and we already have term limits there. But in Congress, if we went to 4-year terms and limited them to, say, 3 terms, that's 12 years. That's a long time to serve and then just go back in the private sector. And the same thing with the Senate. Limit them to 18 years, they go back in the private sector. It is public service, after all.
But, I mean, I think that's the point. You know why we have term limits on the presidency, right? We never had term limits on the presidency until the 1940s.
Right.
There was no term limit. George Washington was such a powerful president that he stood up after his second term and said, I don't think people should serve more than two terms. So as a custom, people never did. But then when Franklin Roosevelt came along, they said, well, there's no term limit to the presidency. That's just something that Washington suggested. So he was elected four times.
Right.
And at that point, we said, we need term limits. You know, so that really is the point. If you don't take matters into your own hands as a politician, the people will do it for you. Sooner or later. So everybody has a vested interest in working together. It's not a one-way street. It's not just, you know, that we as citizens need to pressure Congress and the president. They also need to listen to us.
Yeah.
It's a two-way street.
I totally agree. And when you all are on C-SPAN and we get to watch you, and I know that's great popcorn entertainment, it's not as good as when you have your own radio program and your constituents can call in and they can access or prepare questions in advance that you can address in your radio program. And we'll certainly be listening because
let me give you one of the secrets of the Senate right now. I'm sure you know this, but maybe some of your listeners don't. There's a rule in the Senate that when you're speaking, the camera needs to be on you. This is a good rule because then people can focus their attention on you.
Sure.
The first time I went into the Senate, I realized it's also a practical rule because there's nobody else in the room except the man talking. So when he's pounding his fist and saying, my fellow senators, you need to, he's very often the only person there.
My goodness.
Yeah, so it's very self-serving, and as you point out, on an internet radio show, everybody's there.
Everybody's there, and it's live, so any mistakes you make are not edited out. And we've done a pretty good job for 2.5 hours.
So far, yeah, we haven't said anything. I still feel safer being reelected in 6 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mostly because people will forget what you said 6 years from now.
Well, yeah, maybe they will. We did a good job, though. We covered all the issues, all the main issues, and you did a good job of answering the questions you knew the answers to and letting us know how difficult answering the ones you didn't know the answers to are, and it's a difficult challenge, but it takes engagement and communication, and you're doing the right thing. And by the way, we strongly support D.C. being a state.
Thank you so much, Dr. Agnew. I appreciate being on your show. And I think that really is the bottom line, is that you have to, when you feel strongly about something, you have to speak to it. And if you don't know the answer, you need to stand up and say, I don't know the answer. This is how I feel, but I don't know the answer. And I think that's how we create a dialogue, and that's how people communicate, and that's how we get these important issues to the forefront.
I had one last question. I should have brought this up earlier. Somebody wrote to me already. 40 states have passed sovereignty acts, which are largely legally meaningless, but it's important that the state legislatures have gotten together and at least decided to declare that they're a separate entity inside the United States, not just part of the United States in some respects. It makes it open for the states to begin to take legislative action on a federal level, like, say, a constitutional convention, because they're really feeling the pressure from the federal government usurping their sovereignty as states. What have you heard any discussions at all in the Senate about these rumblings from these 40 states that maybe they're not happy with the way commerce is being handled by the federal government?
Well, that's probably true. And, you know, when the country was set up, that was really one of the major debates. You know, there was a group of people that believed in a strong federal government. But for the most part, the federal government was pretty weak when America was founded. And it really st- state's rights are enumerated, and the state, the most, except for the limited powers outlined in the Constitution of the United States, everything is left to the states besides that. So I think there, it doesn't surprise me at all that there's this backlash, because the federal government has just grown in geometrically since the 1940s. Prior to the 1940s, the federal government really didn't do, they did defense, they did interstate commerce. I mean, there were a handful of things that they handled, but the bureaucracy in Washington, Washington used to be a sleepy little town in the 1940s. It's grown tremendously, and the federal government's power has grown exponentially in the last 70 years. So I'm not surprised that there's sentiment out in the states that they want to reestablish the sovereignty that they feel they had when the country was founded.
Well, that's a very good way of putting it. I never thought of it that way, that when federal government was only handling national defense, general welfare, the basic things that are allotted to it by the Constitution, the states did everything. And I might add, they didn't do a very good job for the most part. Some of them had segregation. They had segregation. They had, you know, all kinds of problems that the federal government had to step in and help with. And now, you're right, we have a very powerful federal government, and the states are feeling intimidated.
Yes. And, you know, that's absolutely true. And it's sometimes it's annoying when you hear a politician stand up and say, it's your tax money. You deserve it. It should be given back at the local level. That's where the money needs to be spent. Because the thing they forget to mention is that state and local government is considerably more corrupt than the federal government. It's harder. That it's not that they can't be just as inefficient or even more inefficient at the federal level in spending your money, but it's harder to steal your money at the federal level. So sometimes this thing that makes sense, giving the money back to you, they forget that caveat that local money gets spent in lots of ways that you might not want it to be spent. So there, you're right. There were plenty of places where the federal government had to intervene, or if they didn't, there would probably still be places where there is segregation and other things that the federal government was able to eradicate. But on the other hand, I'm sure states are feeling the strain of the federal bureaucracy on their back.
Well,
look, even education, which was really only the province of the state. But to desegregate schools, the federal government got involved, right? And they said, if you get any federal money, you need to desegregate. Well, there was no college in America that didn't get some sort of federal money. So they've used the power, their limited power, they've used it over the past 70 years to make the federal government bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think there are a lot of people that object to that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, yeah. And there are a lot of people that don't agree that states are more corrupt than the federal government, because, as you said, all politics is local. And our state legislatures are pretty close to Main Street. If they show any corruption, it doesn't take long for the Harvey homeowner to show up down at the city council or at the state house and make changes. So it happens pretty rapidly.
That's true. But if you look at the statistics, they send a lot more councilmen, mayors, and local bureaucrats to jail than they do federal bureaucrats.
Well, that's a good sign. Most people would think that they are holding them accountable, and if they do something wrong, they go to jail.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But they keep on doing stuff wrong. But that's the what the Constitution says, right? That these enumerated powers are given to Congress and the federal government, and anything in the universe that's not mentioned in that document is supposed to be the purview of the states.
That's what they feel.
Everything else is left to the states. So I'm sure that a lot of states want to establish their sovereignty to reestablish that principle.
Well, it's going to be a fun year, Senator. I really appreciate
it. It will be a fun year, and I'm glad that you're going to be part of it. And as soon as we still got a few finishing touches to put on the first show, but after that, we hope you'll be a regular guest. And it's been a great pleasure talking to you, and thanks so much for sharing your time with me.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. This is what it's all about, and you definitely have my agreement. I'll be a regular guest, and we hear from thousands of people all over the world that are American citizens. Some live in the country, and some do not on a regular basis, and they're concerned. They're expressing their concern about what they feel is, not necessarily federal tyranny, but certainly federal regulators that have run amok. They're just making regulations for regulations.
Let me leave you with this, Dr. Agnew, since you brought up Americans that live abroad. Do you know that if you were to move to France, you could elect senators and congressmen and the president? You could elect senators and congressmen from California, if that's where you lived last, for the next 40 years through absentee ballot. You'd never lose your right to elect people from the state of California, except if you did two things, and they are, one, renounce your American citizenship, or two, move to the District of Columbia.
Oh, that's very good, very good. Don't move to D.C.
Don't move to D.C. Hold on to your rights.
How about that? How about that? Thank you very much, Senator. You've been an awesome guest.
Dr. Agnew.
This archive will be up in a few hours, and our guests will be listening, and listeners will be listening all around the world tomorrow morning.
Great. Well, and I look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
Thanks very much. Good night, Senator.
Thank you. Good night.
All right, Earth Explorers, about 1 minute left to the program. You guys, you listeners, have been awesome. Even though we only had one caller, and that was a very decent question from Myron down in Texas, you have been texting me through Skype all night, and you've heard a lot of the questions that I gave were directly from your texts. Some of them, I, just because of the nature of this program, didn't want to get into, because I'm not here to argue with the senator. I'm here to allow him to make his point the best way he can. And I realize some of you did not agree with that point, and that's fine. That's what America's all about. I will do my best to answer your questions, either by Skype, text, or email. I may write a paper on this and read it next week. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for interacting. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.